We're going to turn to God's Word this morning, and I'm going to ask you to join me in Esther chapter 5, if you have a copy of God's Word. We spent 4 weeks here in Esther back in November, and then we took a little break for Advent and wanting to resume here in the new year to continue this powerful narrative. And one of the things we noted at the outset of this series in Esther was how it shapes our thinking in the culture in which we live. Esther and Mordecai were, of course, operating in a godless pagan culture that was at odds with their values and their allegiances and their morals. And we get a glimpse here for how to live in such a context. Increasingly, that's our context. And so we have some great insights here that I want to draw attention to here this morning. I don't know if you like history. I do, and I like thinking about significant points in history, and I've read some books on along those lines, and some in the area of church history, and that idea of sort of hinge points in the history of the church is just, that's really interesting to me. But one of the things I've thought about is World War II, and if I were to ask you what were the key turning points, the definitive moments in that global conflict, what would you say? We might draw attention, probably the more well-known episodes would be the invasion of Normandy, right? D-Day, the D-Day invasion there on the beaches of Normandy, June 6th, 1944. That was a significant day, certainly in the course of that war. We certainly could look at some of the formal peace alliances. The Germans surrendered on March 8th of 1945. I have a picture of my grandfather who was there in July of 1945 at the Arch de Triomphe there in France. He really didn't get in on any of the conflict at that point. They were smiling. I mean, there was relief. I mean, there was a sense, even at that point when the Germans surrendered, that the war was over. Certainly, that's a very important point. The Japanese surrendered later, August 14th of 1945. So we can look at a lot of these different significant points that we might think about when we think about the end of the war. But most historians believe that the real turning point was the Battle of Stalingrad in southern Russia. Hitler was intent on taking this Russian city, strategic Russian city. It was a major industrial area, could be used for the development of weapons, and was important for a variety of different reasons. And so Hitler made a full court press on this city. And the battle raged for 7 months. There were 2 million casualties, both civilian and military. It was a horrible scene in the back alleys of that once great city. The German troops ultimately would surrender February 2nd of 1943, more than a year before the invasion in Normandy. But this was the last offensive for the Nazi armies. From this point on, it was retreat. And so this seems to be the key turning point in World War II. Interesting to think about that concept even as it relates to our own lives, isn't it? What are the turning points? Could you identify the 1, 2, 3 turning points in your life? Maybe a really painful childhood experience that left an indelible mark on your character, right? It just shaped who you are and what's important to you. Right? Maybe a focused conversation that directed you onto a certain career path. Hopefully on that list is an encounter, an awareness of your sin, and a point where you encountered Jesus and looked to Him to be your Savior and Lord. Right? Well, this morning here in Esther, we're going to look at the turning point in this great epic narrative. The book of Esther has a very purposeful and intentional structure. It'll be a little more apparent even as we move into the end of the book, and we'll try to draw attention to it. But we certainly see it here in Esther 5 through 7. This is the portion we're going to look at today. We're not going to look at all of it in detail. We're not going to read all of it. It's a larger section. But it is the turning point in the account. And one of the methods that would be used in biblical literature is what's called a chiasm. And it's we usually will divide up a book by, we might have chapter divisions, right? Very clear, overt chapter divisions. And we might even have like section divisions, like, okay, here's part one, chapter one. And then you move into part two of the narrative. But Hebrew writing is generally a little more subtle than that. It doesn't just tell you, but it's structured in such an intricate way that the structure itself of the narrative draws attention to the point. And that is certainly true here in the book of Esther. A chiasm is simply a series of parallel sections that all work towards a focal point. And so here we have Haman's decree. We've considered this in past weeks. Haman issued a decree and got the endorsement of the king to have the Jewish people annihilated. And then we have Esther's first banquet. This is in chapter 5 here. Esther throws two banquets, which is a bit curious. But the structure helps us understand a little bit. And then we have the fate of the Jews, specifically the fate of Mordecai, right? What is going to happen to Mordecai? And that is chapter 6. That's really the point we're really going to focus on today. And then, as the narrative continues, we have Esther throwing a second banquet that parallels the first one. And then we have Mordecai's decree that corresponds with the decree that was issued by Haman. And so we could expand this out to look at the whole book. I'm just including this little point here where it comes together. And this is a critical section. It is the turning point. Well, we have a little bit of catching up to do, don't we? Because we have been out of Esther here for a few weeks. So where are we at in the story? Let's just do a quick recap here. We first of all encountered the dominance of Persian culture, the opulence, the wealth, the military power, the banquets that lasted for 6 months, right? All of the extravagant, we're just meant to see this picture of Persian power. And along with that, we see the king, King Ahasuerus, otherwise known as King Xerxes. We see the king, this godless king, lacking really any real moral direction, moral compass. He's given to drunkenness. He's given to fits of anger. This is just not a good scene here in Persia, right? Powerful, but godless. And then we're introduced to two Jewish individuals, Mordecai and Esther. And they stand in distinction from that culture. Matter of fact, they win the favor of those around them. They stand out. They are admired. They are respected. And their lifestyle is exemplary. And then, of course, those two worlds collide. We see the Jews coming under fire. They are opposed, particularly by one particular Persian man named Haman. And Haman has a backstory. Haman is an Agagite. He's part of the Amalekites, who were the historic enemy of the Jewish people. And we looked and traced all the different encounters, all the different battles between the Amalekites and the Israelites. And that now comes to the forefront again, this great battle. And Haman is intent on destroying the Jewish people. So the moment of crisis comes, and Mordecai appeals to Esther. Esther has become the queen. She's in a very unique position. And Mordecai says, you need to go to the king. Who knows, but what you have been brought to this very position for this very moment. You need to use your influence with the king to avert the destruction of our people. And so Esther steps into the gap. She agrees to go. She says, if I perish, I perish. She has no assurances that she will be spared or that the plan will work, but she courageously moves forward and stands in the gap for her people. So that brings us here to chapter 5. We're going to pick up the account here at this key turning point. Of course, Mordecai and Esther didn't know it was a turning point, did they? They just knew that the situation was bleak. And I think we see here some really key lessons about how to live when the situation seems irreversible. The situation seems overwhelming. And there doesn't seem to be any way out. How do we live in such, in the context of such hostility when the deck seems stacked against us? And certainly we see some great lessons that emerge out of this text. The first thing I want to draw your attention to is this, the first lesson, and that is to have the courage to speak and the wisdom to speak well. And I want us to note Esther's encounter here with the king. Beginning in chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." So Mordecai challenges Esther to action, and Esther risked everything and went to the king. That was not something that you did. The penalty for going to the king uninvited in this culture was death. And so Esther took her life into her hands. We certainly ought to emulate Esther's courage, but I would also suggest that we should emulate her wise and gracious manner. That she has already won the favor of the eunuch that was in charge of the king's harem. She, of course, won the king's favor. She, among all the other beautiful women of the kingdom, was chosen to be queen. And now here again, she wins the king's favor. She is a gracious woman. She is one who is attractive in every way. She is one that you want to be around. She's been fasting for 3 days. She was presumably wearing sackcloth along with her countrymen. She had called all of her countrymen to fast with her on her behalf as she was preparing to go into the king. But of course, we'd already read that sackcloth isn't permitted in the palace. You don't bring your sad faces to the king. He doesn't want anyone raining on his party or in impeding on his happiness. And so Esther dresses in her finest clothes, and she doesn't appear with a scowl or she goes to him and in a way that is appropriate. And she doesn't just barge into the throne room unannounced with her demands. She stands in the background at a respectable distance and waits for the king to acknowledge her and welcome her. The king, of course, asks her what her request is. He says, "Up to half the kingdom, Esther, I will give it to you. What do you want?" He knew that she would not approach him in this way for some trivial matter. And Esther simply says, I would like for you and Haman to come to a banquet that I have prepared. If we were to continue reading in chapter 5, we would find that the king and Haman do come to that banquet, and the king again says to Esther, what do you want? Up to half the kingdom. Tell me, what is your request? And Esther again says, my request is that you and Haman come to another banquet that I have prepared for you tomorrow. So it seems on the surface that Esther has missed two very important opportunities to tell the king what was on her mind. Right? I don't believe that Esther held back in fear, but rather that she navigated the situation with wisdom. She wants to make sure that the time was right. She's setting this up for success. Perhaps she knew that he would be more relaxed around a table with a glass of wine. This was a king who liked to drink. He never turned down a glass of wine. Right? Every time we see him in this text, he's holding wine. And Esther seems to understand the workings of the king, and she understands how the king is wired, and she understands what is going to make for a receptive, productive conversation. We don't know exactly what Esther was trying to accomplish, but she approached the matter with great skill and cultural intelligence. We are very brash as Americans. Chinese had a name for us, Lao Wai. Is that the name? Jack's laughing. Lao Wai. And it means foreigner, but it kind of means more than that. It means kind of like loud person. That's the American reputation, right? That we are very brash. And Esther navigates this situation in a way that seemingly was consistent with the culture. And evidences not only courage, but wisdom and grace. One of the byproducts of this first banquet, again, we don't know exactly what Esther was intending, why she did it this way, why she hosted two banquets, why she didn't bring the request immediately. But one of the outcomes was that it seemed to fuel Haman's pride. Haman left that first banquet just so full of himself. He alone was invited to come to a banquet with the king and Esther. And he goes home and he tells his wife about it, and he calls his friends to come on over and tells them all about his experience at this important event. But it also makes Haman angry. As his ego is being stroked and his pride is being fed, he walks out on his way home and he encounters Mordecai. And once again, Mordecai does not bow before him or tremble in his presence. And so he is just consumed here with his hatred for Mordecai. Notice the response here in verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So again, one of the impacts of this first banquet that Esther threw was to fuel Haman's pride, to fatten him up, to make him filled with rage towards Mordecai and overconfident. We notice here his poisoned mind. Matter of fact, I was challenged reading about Haman here this week. How many times do I allow a circumstance to poison my thinking, right? One hard thing in my life, and I let it become big, and I forget all of God's many blessings. look at Haman. He's recounting all the things that he has and all the ways in which he has been prospered, and yet Mordecai, this one guy, he's got this sour spirit right about him, and even makes us notice Esther more, right? Who in the midst of a terrible, terrible circumstance is marked by courage and grace. Proverbs 27:14 says, if a man loudly blesses his neighbor early in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. Might say the right thing, but say it at the wrong time. A wise person is concerned not only with what they say, but with how they say it. And certainly when we face difficult circumstances, when we face instances of injustice, those are easy opportunities for us to become angry, right? To become bitter, to become calloused. And we should seek to display grace under pressure. We should have the courage to speak and the wisdom to speak well. Secondly, trust God to bring about justice in His time and in His way. Another great lesson that surfaces out of this text is the providence of God to make things right. Chapter 6, on that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. And the king said, who is that in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So the king is having trouble sleeping, and he calls for the official records to be brought to him and read to him. This is not exactly a page-turning material here. This is intended to help him sleep. And so the readers are droning on, kind of white noise there, to maybe help the king forget about his troubles. But late in the night, as they are reading, something catches his attention. He is reminded of how Mordecai exposed an assassination attempt on his life. Mordecai had saved his life. And as the conversation goes on, he is troubled by the fact that nothing was done to honor or thank Mordecai. So his mind is racing. He is mulling over and thinking about how he can honor Mordecai. It's now early in the morning, and he hears something out in the outer court. He says, Who's out there? And they come back and say, well, it's Haman. Haman's here early this morning. And the king says, well, send him in. Maybe he can help me think about how to honor Mordecai. Well, Haman, too, it seems, had had trouble sleeping. Haman had been thinking since the banquet with Esther and his encounter with Mordecai the day before. He had been thinking about how to do away with Mordecai. And his friends and his wife helped him come up with some good ideas. It was not enough for Mordecai to be simply killed with the other Jews in the coming genocide that would happen. But Mordecai had to be humiliated. He had to die a disgraceful death. Mordecai's death needed to be a statement. And so he constructs these tall gallows for this specific purpose. So he's been thinking about this too. He's anxious to come and talk to the king and to bring his request to the king and get approval, get this signed off. He's looking for how to kill Mordecai, and at the same time, the king is looking for how to honor Mordecai. The king asks Haman what should be done for the man that the king delights to honor, and Haman is thinking, who would he want to honor but me? He describes a grandiose scene over the top of how he would want to be honored, and then the king says, great, sounds perfect, go and do that for Mordecai. This great rehearsal, reversal that takes place here in the king's court. Of course, Esther and Mordecai had stepped into action. They had fasted, presumably been in prayer regarding this. Esther steps out boldly to speak to the king about an important request, and she's put that in motion. But now we find that it's God who's doing the heavy lifting, right? God is the one who's working behind the scenes to guide the thoughts and activities of both the king and Haman. This isn't Esther and Mordecai here in chapter 6. This is God. God isn't mentioned in Esther, and that's part of the literary design, but we're intended to see that even when God is invisible, even when God is not seen or heard, he is at work. And so God is doing this great work, and we would do well to remember and to trust that God will bring about justice in his time and in his way. There's always a temptation to think that what we are doing in the day-to-day doesn't really matter. Right? Look at Mordecai. Selfless action, heroic deed. He saved the king, but it was forgotten. Nothing seemed to come of it. Mordecai was not rewarded or promoted. As a matter of fact, Haman was promoted. Right? But Mordecai's service did matter, and it was not forgotten. And eventually, the king remembered. And of course, God is much more generous than King Ahasuerus, and he never forgets. God ensures that no good service will be overlooked. We're told in 1 Corinthians 15, that great encouraging passage, know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. It is not empty. It it will be remembered, it will be significant, it will be purposeful. There's always the temptation to think not only that our own efforts might not matter, that service, that class that I'm involved in, that service project, that volunteer effort, work at Olivia's Gift, right? Whatever it might be, always the temptation to think, oh, it doesn't really matter that much. No one notices, no one appreciates. And it's also sometimes a temptation to think that people that are involved in wickedness, people that aren't interested in the things of God, that their injustices and their selfishness will go unpunished. And when we face desperate and seemingly irreversible situations, we need to remember that God always makes things right. In His time, in His way. We don't have to keep score. I don't have to become infatuated with it. I can trust that God will sort it out in His own way. Great reminder here out of this text. Number three, remember that you're part of a larger story. Notice what happens when Haman returns home. Verse 12, chapter 6, verse 12. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." So he goes to them and they utter this really doomsday prophecy over Haman. They say, "Oh, this is not good. This is not good. If you have begun to fall before Mordecai, this Jewish man of the Jewish people, then this does not bode well for you." Interesting, isn't it? They don't see it simply as a personal squabble between Mordecai and Haman. There's something much bigger being played out here. There was a long-standing struggle between the Israelites and the Amalekites. They knew it. They were aware of it. And they knew the prophecies that had been made about the Amalekites, that God would bring about His justice. The Amalekites had perpetrated horrible crimes against Israel. They tried to wipe them out on multiple occasions. And God had said that He was going to bring justice against the Amalekites. And Haman's own wife and his friends say, "It looks like it's coming to pass." Right? Isn't that interesting that there's something bigger going on? Sometimes we get caught up in the interpersonal issues and we forget that there's a bigger narrative that's being played out here. It wasn't just about Mordecai. It was about the Jewish people. It was about the line of the Messiah. It was about God's promises. All of this was at stake. And when we encounter difficulties personally and injustices and seemingly irreversible situations, we would do well to remember that there is a bigger narrative that's being played out. Finally, know that God uses even ungodly leaders to accomplish His purposes. Know that God uses even ungodly leaders to accomplish His purposes. Chapter 6, verse 14. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. It's now the second feast, right? So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther, and on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted to me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, "Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high." And the king said, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. So finally, the king again says to Esther, "What is your request? Tell me." And she says, "My request is that my life be spared. My request is that the lives of my people be spared." And God brings about judgment on Haman, not through the Jews, but through a pagan, godless king. God is not thwarted by godless rulers. I'm convinced that God is not nearly concerned about who the president is as we are. Proverbs 21 says, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Seeing the DeKrygers here this morning, I was thinking about their political situation in Togo. Want to talk about a situation? The current president, I'm not going to get the pronunciation right, Faure Gnassingbe. Throwing a little French in there. He's ruled the country of Togo for 12 years. And he assumed the rule from his father, who had taken control in a coup attempt back in 1967. And the father changed the constitution and the age requirements in order for his son to be able to continue as president. Against all constitutional laws, it's a bad situation. Matter of fact, they have ruled for over 50 years, been in power longer than any other African regime. And it's not good, it's unjust, and yet God has used it. God has maintained a degree of peace there through this man that has allowed the Hospital of Hope to be built. I don't know all the ins and outs. I just know that that president does not stand in the way of God's purposes. And we need to remember that, even when governments and regimes seem to be against us. God specializes in great reversals. All the good things that Haman wanted for himself were given to Mordecai. And all the bad things that Haman wanted for Mordecai came back on himself, right? It's just like God. Do it that way. Matter of fact, we could recount it again and again and again. It's the story of Abraham and Sarah, who were able to have children only after their childbearing years. It's the story of the Hebrew slaves who were delivered only after being hemmed in by Pharaoh's army in the Red Sea. It's the story of Samson, who achieved his greatest victory after having his eyes put out. It's the story of Gideon, who achieved victory over an innumerable army only after his own army had been reduced to 300 men. It's the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Lazarus suffering under the oppression of this prosperous but godless rich man. But finding that it was to be reversed in the life to come, where Lazarus is comforted and the rich man is tormented. And certainly we see it most clearly in the cross, when all seemed lost and the Son of God was deserted by his followers, by his disciples. He hung on a cruel Roman cross. It was at that moment that God brought about the greatest victory of all. Victory over sin and death and Satan. And it's what we celebrate today. So I'm going to ask our musicians to make their way up as we turn attention to the Lord's table here this morning. There's another interesting thing I'd like to point out regarding Esther's request, and that is that Esther brought this request. She came to the king during the Passover feast. Haman initially gave his pronouncement. He wanted to ruin the Passover feast for the Jews. So he issued his declaration and had it sent throughout the kingdom on the eve of Passover. But during Passover, Esther comes and intercedes for her people. And God brings about a great deliverance. Right? It was on Passover many years previous that God had delivered his people out of Egypt. He brought judgment on the Egyptians, but he spared his people. And it would be on Passover 500 years later that God would send his Son as the perfect Lamb of God to bring the greatest deliverance of all.